Hello and welcome back to the Medic 101 podcast. This is Brenton Burr. This is part two, airway expertise with anesthetist Justin Bateman. If you haven't listened to part one yet, go check it out. And if you already have, enjoy part two. Thanks.
Well, let's talk about some more airway management techniques. I know we've had some discussions on this and you spoke with some of our students before on this in the past, Mac versus Miller.
So my opinion on this, and it's widely held throughout most of the anesthesia community, is that the Mac blade is an easier blade to learn on. So there's less of a learning curve. You can usually get away with less repetitions to become proficient. However, the Miller blade, because of its design and the way that it works on the airway, it will manage more difficult airways and solve more airway problems than the Mac will.
Okay. So more of...
But it does require a significantly higher learning curve than the Miller does. And part of it is simply because not only are you managing the tongue with the Miller, but you also now have to manage the epiglottis with the Miller. And so that now you're dealing with a lot more tissue. The other thing too with the Miller is it's not the lifting motion, kind of the brute strength lifting motion that the Mac is in the molecular space. The Miller is simply moving tissue out of the way to give it your tube a pathway to the vocal cords where you can then pass it into the trachea. So because you don't have to have any motion with the neck in order for the blade to be successful, you can often solve airways that the Miller, due to an inability for the neck to move, it can solve that. Also, it's a much smaller blade, so people with small mouth openings often are more successful in that regard. You have a lot more room for other equipment to get into the mouth. So with the Mac, it's easier because when you get in and as soon as you get the tongue out of the way, your next big thing is going to be the epiglottis. And finding the molecular space is often a lot easier because the next piece of tissue straight in front of you after the tongue is the epiglottis and you just stick it in there. So as you're learning, I would say start with the Mac and become proficient with it first. I get it. You may feel like you've got some cool points with the Miller, but at the end of the day, the success is what's more important.
Yeah. So you may find the Miller in the hands of experts more often than the Mac, or?
Oh, for sure. You see with anesthesia students all the time is that most anesthesia students, unless they have put a very concentrated effort in, finish anesthesia school using almost primarily the Mac. And then over time, I mean, I spent 3 years where Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I used a Miller blade, and Tuesday, Thursday, I used a Mac blade. And 4 years into it, all I ever use is a Miller now. But I mean, even for me doing it, intubating 5-6 times a day, you know, 20 to 40 times a week, took me a few years to truly become masterful with the Miller blade.
Gotcha. See, I'm Mac 3 myself on pretty much most any attempt I've ever had to do. And I guess I'm good with that. I'll probably never be good enough for the Miller. I'm going to stick with what I got. I'm going to roll with it. It seems to be working. All right, let's talk about some other ideas. So a lot of EMS agencies are bringing out video laryngoscopy to the field. How do you feel about that versus direct laryngoscopy? Has it taken over? It's like, has VL killed the DL, or is it?
So even in the hospital setting, we utilize video laryngoscopy on occasion. And where we utilize it mostly are with the morbidly obese patients or patients with extremely limited neck mobility. And part of it is because with the blade shape that you're able to have with a video laryngoscopy unit, you are able to have a different view than you are with the direct. Part of it is because with video, you don't need to move the tongue out of the way. You simply go down the center line. And you're able to usually, it's almost exclusively, you're going to find that molecular space. And then from there, you're going to create your view. Now, one of the things is that obviously you don't always get a good view. Sometimes all you have is a video of a bad view. And at that point, a lot of it comes down to, do you have enough experience to be able to pass a tube through an epiglottis that's completely blocking your vision and actually get it into the trachea? Now, I can tell you from experience, that takes quite a few years and a lot of tubes till where you can say, you know what, I can do this blind almost, you know, every time. So I feel like the video has an advantage in that you don't have to move the tongue out of the way. You can see right where the molecular space is, especially with the advent of high definition cameras that most of us have now. And that you're able to at least get a view of, say, the arytenoids.
Okay.
And from there, you're able to kind of identify, and you're able to have a second set of eyes try and identify what's going on if you've got two of you there. So the advantage of that is the video.
So would you, with video laryngoscopy, who would you break that out first on then? So versus direct laryngoscopy, is that going to be those more of the obese patients, predicted difficult airway patients?
Because so
in the
say,
field, we don't have like a ton of time to determine, but so, obviously the large guy, the short neck.
So anybody who you think could be a difficult airway. And part of it is, if you feel like this is somebody that I'm going to bring the video out just in case I fail with my direct, why not just go straight to the video?
Okay.
So you're going to find that morbidly obese guy, somebody with limited neck range of motion. The other time that video comes in for paramedic settings that are absolutely fantastic is when you have to do that face-to-face intubation, where it makes a world of difference. I mean, you can do it with a Mac, and I've done it with a Mac, but it's far easier with a video device when they're strapped into that passenger seat and you can't get them out, but you just need to get their airway. All of a sudden, now you're able to see what's going on.
Perfect. So is there any patients then that would benefit? So are basically you're saying, because I've seen this go a couple ways in my experience in the hospital, but would video always be better for the difficult airway? Or is there sometimes where direct laryngoscopy would still reign supreme? I don't know.
So when you, with direct laryngoscopy, you have far more ability to manipulate the tissue. So when you get certain patients that either have extremely a lot of swelling, a lot of tissue, or even who have just kind of a larger than normal tongue, I would tend to go with a direct laryngoscopy simply because I can control and manage what's going on with that tissue rather than simply hoping that my video view is okay. The other thing too is that for me and for most of us in anesthesia, the direct laryngoscopy always gives us the option of the Miller, which can move all of the tissue, including that epiglottis, out of the way. Because sometimes what happens is you get into the molecular space and you've got a huge epiglottis, and no matter how much you're lifting, the epiglottis never fully folds up enough for you to actually get a view.
Fair enough. And I've seen some instances, and I don't know if this was just bad technique or what the issue was, but I've seen a lot of times with video, maybe it was just older machines, fogging up with a spontaneously breathing patient if they're breathing at all, as well as if you get anything like with wet airways on it, it'll focus on it and cause issues as well. So, is that fixed at all with newer? I mean, so obviously the fogging, if there's something on it. But
the fogging issue for the most part is fixed with video laryngoscopy. Now, one huge disadvantage that you did raise is patients who have large amounts of secretions, who have thrown up, who have anything sitting in there, and that's simply because there's no way to clean that video device.
Yeah.
So if you get something that obscures your video view, you now have nothing. So in any of those patients that potentially have stuff already in their airway, the video is probably not going to be the way to go.
All right. So let's talk about as well. I've seen, so video laryngoscopy versus direct laryngoscopy. I've seen many anesthetists in the trauma center I worked at. I've seen ER doctors kind of flail with both. And the gum bougie always seems to be like the last thing that gets out, that comes out, and it'll get that airway and saves the day. How do you feel about the gum bougie, and where does it sit in your arsenal?
So I think the bougie is probably one of the most underutilized pieces of airway equipment, especially in the field setting. Any of the tactical medics that I work with, any of the field medics that I work with, I make them put bougies in all their tubes. So the thing is, even for me, for somebody who has done this 15, 20, 30,000 times, in the difficult airway, the bougie is what I go to every time. And in my currently, I don't intubate with a stylet simply because I know that if I run into a situation where I need to use a stylet, if it were to fail, I'd immediately go to a bougie. So rather than have that intermediate step, I simply go to a bougie. And I would say 90% of my patients, I can intubate without a stylet. I just don't need it because I'm able to position them well and then my technique's good. But the other 10% were so difficult that a bougie probably would have happened anyways. So if I go to that.
So skip a few steps right. And save a lot of time in the long run.
So, and the thing is, I think one of the things with this, especially as paramedic, is the bougie needs to not be viewed as a crutch or something that people who aren't good at it or somebody who's incompetent uses. The bougie needs to be viewed as the ultimate and easiest airway secure tool that you can take just the view of the arytenoid and you can take that tiny little bougie and pass it through the cords. It's far easier to manipulate the bougie than it is a full-size tube, even with a stylet in it.
I've seen it be used so many times, you know, at the trauma center as like the last, after so many people have tried so many different attempts at managing someone's airway, and the gum bougie always seems to be like the last common thing while someone else is breaking out a crite kit and seems to, you know, gum bougie always seems to win. I'm a big proponent after seeing all that and doing a bunch of other research on gum bougie first attempt, every attempt. I mean, I'm not an airway expert. I'm not a master. I don't have, you know, all my patients that do need to be intubated. You know, we don't have all of the information we want. We don't have the ideal circumstances. And I'm a big fan of just dropping bougie first go. Guarantee my success, guarantee or help achieve first pass success.
I think it's a great idea, especially with the understanding, and you've got the understanding that you're going into this as somebody who isn't super proficient at this. And so why not maximize right from the get-go that if you are going to run into any sort of problems, you have the tool right there. And if you don't have a problem, count it as a huge win. Use the bougie. The other thing too is the bougie doesn't have to go into the trachea. You can have the bougie in, get a great view, get that tube lined up, and you don't need to push the bougie through the cords. You can simply then, hey, somebody take it out, or you can just take it out yourself and then advance the tube. So I think view it as the ultimate stylet.
Yeah.
You know, load it up, use it. There's no reason not to.
Great, great. I love the bougie. Big fan. Anyway, so let's talk about, so I guess we can take kind of a few steps back. So before all these different attempts at airway management, different blades and video versus DL, I think to guarantee your success, one of the first things that needs to happen is going to be the positioning. And really, all the prep work that goes into a successful airway, it's all the prep work that makes you successful. But I think proper positioning is huge. And I think with mannequins, this is where we kind of mess up in that many mannequins allow for you to just crank their head back. You see many paramedics, any pictures you see online or anywhere of paramedic students intubating, they're just cranking the head back on the Laridol mannequin or whatever they are, and just ramming a tube straight down. I don't see that actually occurring in the field. Agree.
As I say, so positioning is a huge determinant of whether or not your view will be successful. Even in the operating room as anesthesia students, one of the biggest problems people run into is not positioning the patient well. I mean, simple things like the bed height. I'm 6'3". When I bring that bed up, it is to where that patient is at my chest level. I mean, I have attendings. I remember as a student, I had attendings that say, I can't see anything because the bed's so high. But it didn't matter because that's where I needed it for all of my axes and planes to line up when I got a good view. So this really has a lot of things where you get these morbidly obese patients and adding a ramp where you put blankets, pillows, jackets, whatever it is to where you ramp that patient up. We talk about the sniffing position. The sniffing position is great if it can be done, but often it can't. And so what we need to do is positionally create that same manipulation of our axis through positioning rather than moving the head around. And I think a lot of times people don't realize the value in, if it takes me 30 or 45 seconds to properly position the patient, that may be the difference between a successful intubation or not. And this is where we go back now all of a sudden to that bag masking. Yeah. If I can successfully bag mask, then I have a little extra time to properly position or better position the patient to set me up for success. I think that leads us into also talking about supraglottics.
Yeah, so it's that. But before we get too far with that, what is proper positioning? So we talking about sniffing position and no one honestly could really recite that, but what is the proper position? What do you do to prepare your patients for intubation? So typically what we do is elevate the head is what you usually end up resulting with. But
so, I mean, one of the big things is that I talk about axis and it's that we have And if you're listening to this, Google it. Just Google ideal intubating position. It'll come up with a couple of diagrams, and there'll be three different axes that are talked about. And that's going to be the oral axis, the pharyngeal axis, and the laryngeal. Our natural head resting on the ground, we have an oral axis that's going to be almost perpendicular to our laryngeal axis, and then our pharyngeal, which is intersecting the laryngeal and oral axis. And so what that creates is kind of 45 degree angles that obscure your vision. And this is why, so if your bed's too low and I start to look down into the patient's mouth, rather than having a straight line of sight to where the trachea is, all I see is the back of their throat. And it's because I'm at such a steep angle that I can't see them. And so when we talk about proper positioning, what we're trying to do is bring into alignment that pharyngeal axis and the laryngeal axis, and then as best as possible, the oral one, so that all of them are ideally perpendicular to each other. So we have a straight view path that goes from the mouth all the way to the cords. Now, often with obese patients, the sniffing position doesn't matter because they have so much mass to them that it won't ever line up the axis. And this is where that ramping position comes into
play. I'll have to throw out some links to this in the show notes, and we'll be able to show some pictures of that. So positioning, I've seen this too in the hospitals as well. Working at a busy hospital down, and I was down in Fort Myers, Florida. We would see many of our ER physicians, when they go to intubate or anesthesia, they're going to raise the bed up almost about as high as it'll go. But you've seen many, I guess, less experienced physicians in rural areas. They don't. And if you walk in the, I've seen it, you know, EMS, I've seen it in hospitals, whatever, and they'll have the bed really low and they're squatted down. They're trying, they just can't see anything. They scream and they can't see anything. And then watching them, you know, just jack the bed up a little bit and then, all right, I can see it now. You know, just getting into the better alignment. What about head of bed 30 degrees? So OR tables are pretty flat, right? They just do supine, then they really go up. But what about, so ER stretchers, EMS stretchers, we're able to lift the head up to like a semi-Fowler. So does that offer any benefit? So, I mean, it's kind of like ramping, but not.
Right. So in essence, all you've done is created an artificial ramp. It accomplishes the same thing in essence. And we on our OR tables now often on the table can move the back up and down. And especially in the larger patients, you'll see almost all of us at 30 to 40 degrees bringing that patient up. And it does a couple of things. One is that it does gravity tend to pull some of that tissue away. On some of these bigger patients, obviously reflux is a big thing that helps alleviate that a little bit. And then as far as alignment goes, it does set you up for a much more streamlined view down to where the trachea is. So,
perfect. Cool. All right. Now, we've talked a bunch about intubation, but let's talk about supraglottic airways for a little bit here, because I'm a huge fan of supraglottic airways.
I mean, maybe I'm a huge fan of supraglottic airways.
Some of the places I've worked, they kind of mandate it. So for cardiac arrest, you know, you know, we drop supraglottics first, unless you just couldn't manage their airway with that. But how do you feel about them, say, in the pre-hospital environment or in the hands of a less experienced intubator? What do you think?
Oh, I think the supraglottic, again, is also a very underutilized thing. Even as a professional, the supraglottic has a key place in our difficult airway algorithm. And even in the hospital setting, if we have patients, especially we go down for any sort of trauma, any sort of ER where we've got an emergency airway, often the supraglottic is what we put in first to buy time and do that thorough pre-oxygenation. The supraglottic doesn't need to be looked at as a definitive airway. It isn't a definitive airway. We know one of the big disadvantages of the supraglottic is that we don't have anything in the esophagus. The king you can, we don't have a definitive airway because we don't have a cuff in the trachea. So that's the endotracheal tube allows us to put a cuff in the trachea, which means we now completely eliminate the ability to have any sort of aspiration risk. Now, the supraglottic, while it's not a definitive airway, what it does do is allow far easier time bagging, far easier time more efficiently moving oxygen. These are great in the patient that, look, the only way that I'm moving air is by doing a double-handed jaw thrust and my partner squeezes the bag. At that point, we're using three of our four hands to try and ventilate this guy. Put in a supraglottic airway. Or let's say we've got a patient that we are worried about aspiration, whether it's due to the size, whether it's due to maybe they've just eaten something, whatever the case may be, we may know that ultimately we need to get a tube into them, but we need to buy ourselves a little bit of time. That supraglottic often can be the pre-oxygenation difference or allow mm-hmm. us to set everything up. Or we've made an attempt. It's been unsuccessful. Put the supraglottic in. Buy yourself a little bit more time and then make that second look because you know, hey, we need to have a definitive airway in this. The supraglottic needs to not be viewed as a crutch. It needs to not be viewed as something that poor or weak people use. It is an integral part of your airway algorithm.
Yeah, I think with you've talked about egos with paramedics earlier. That is definitely a thing, and many of them would look at the supraglottic as, well, I couldn't intubate, and it was always in your filled out airway algorithm, but it shouldn't. I mean,
If you think about it, even in the hospital setting, we do tons of cases where the entire thing is with a supraglottic airway. If it truly wasn't something of value, we would intubate every single patient, but we don't. We use LMAs on patients all day, every day, and it's because it's a very effective airway.
Now you use LMAs, you're familiar with King tubes, do you use iGels at all?
So I've used the iGels.
The ease of placement with the iGel is only like a few seconds longer than an OPA as far as I'm concerned, and they can be placed by a less experienced, so an advanced EMT or an EMT intermediate can place those airways while the paramedic is getting their stuff together, preparing for that intubation, down the road, and they can have guarantee that success with the intubation.
So the iGel,
a lot of time.
The iGel, in fact, is so easy to use that the Committee for Tactical Combat Casualty Care has come out and officially endorsed the iGel as the supraglottic airway of choice. And the big thing is the way that it's designed, there's less material that can get folded funny or get caught. There is a bit of a technique to a regular LMA. And this is one of those that, when you're doing your clinical settings, ask to do the LMAs. And then when you run into a problem, ask them to, what are the techniques to solve it? How do you get a finger in there and kind of make the tip of the LMA round the back of the throat? The iGel doesn't run into that. There's another LMA called a Quick Set that I really like. I use it and carry that in my aid bag, but the iGel is fantastic. I think if you've got a choice, the iGel is probably the way to go for a less experienced person.
Perfect. Yeah, I'm a big fan. I worked at a few agencies that had those, and that when they first came out, we were reluctant, but they are so easy to use. And yeah, it's not that once you place it, you bought that airway. You can now go to other options and have a better chance at success for that. And we've used them basically as an OPA, eliminate that bag valve mask tricks by just going straight to it.
A lot of people outside of anesthesia have no idea or don't realize is that in anesthesia, we simply consider a supraglottic an ultimate oral airway. There are lots of surgeries that we take the person to pack you with a supraglottic in simply because it's acting like an oral airway.
Really
rather than
OPA.
Pull it out and just put an oral airway in, you can chew on the tube, you can move your tongue around, you can wake up, it won't cause you to gag, and then you just spit it out. It's just, we use them all the time.
Let's talk about another deal here with intubation medication. So the medications you use are a little bit different than the meds that we use, or the meds that you use on a regular basis, I think, would be a little bit different due to the types of patients that we may have to take their airways on. And we also have some limitations with some services with paralytics. So RSI, versus a sedation-assisted intubation. Is that a big hit if you can't have paralytics? What would that change as far as who you would intubate or what you would have to do to manage someone's airway?
I would not say it would affect it. However, in order to compensate for not perhaps having access to the RSI drugs, you do need to be very well read on dosages and feel comfortable with the dosages for sedation-assisted intubation. I think one of the things is that people either haven't done enough research or don't have enough experience to where they give sufficient drugs to truly be sedated. And I think with adequate sedation, the likelihood of you running into any sort of problems is.
All right. So I've seen some studies looking at, first pass success with RSI versus, say, etomidate only and RSA being higher. But do you think it may be attributed to just too low of a sedation dose or?
I think for sure. The other thing, too, is, obviously the paralytic does create a more ideal. But one of the things we run into, even when we're doing, say, when I'm doing a ketamine only induction, because we can't always use sucks. We can't always use a paralytic. And so even when I'm intubating on ketamine, one of the big things is give it enough time to act. If you don't know how the drug's going to act, a lot of times you feel rushed. We get it that all of a sudden they're not breathing. We need to put an airway in. You feel that pressure. But if you have adequate pre-oxygenation, you have sufficient time to let the drugs act. And that's one of the drawbacks with all of sedation drugs. They take longer. This is like going to sleep with rock versus succinyl choline. That rock, you need to have a good 120, ideally, if you can wait 3 minutes before you intubate. Now you've got ideal intubating conditions. Now you can do an RSI dose of rock, but that's another one of those instances where you have to know the drug, because I need to change my dose so that it's acting fast enough that I actually get that RSI-like condition.
All right, so RSI versus sedation-assisted intubation. Now, what about intubating with meds, without meds at all? So who would benefit from that, or who would you just do that on? Who would you like, hey, let's just go ahead and give meds now, or let's attempt it without meds?
So most of the people that I've done without medications are patients that either are about to receive cardiopulmonary resuscitation or have had some sort of crash. They've either been shocked or they've been CPR'd back into some sort of rhythm. And at that point, I've been able to successfully pass the tube without any problem. And it's usually just the patients that are so kind of in poor shape that their body simply is trying to deal with all of the other traumatic things rather than have.
Yeah. So that is pretty much reserved. So intubating without meds would be pretty much reserved to GCS at 3, or?
Probably. I mean, this is kind of one of those that you can try it.
Yeah. I mean, if it doesn't work out.
If it doesn't work, then
try meds.
Move on. Right.
Fair enough. All right. Now, if you would tell us a little bit about PEEP. So we use PEEP, the CPAP, we're pretty familiar with it, but the idea of attaching PEEP to a bag valve mask is still kind of foreign to a lot of us in EMS.
So PEEP for me is one of the time that I really start to go to PEEP is any time that I'm worried about any sort of atelectasis. That if we are concerned about large amounts of pressure on the alveoli, whether that be to, could be heavy smokers, COPD, it could be just large patients that simply have a lot of chest mass that they're bedridden, or they're in their recliner and that's kind of where they live. And all of a sudden, you know that when I want to build up reserves, when I'm doing that bag mouth vast to try and build up reserves, I need to recruit that alveoli that's all collapsed. And that's where that PEEP is going to really start to be advantageous so that we can really open up and expand, that oxygen reserve.
So does it play a role for you at all, or would it benefit us in pre-hospital to use that as like a pre-oxygenation tool?
Absolutely. So this is another one that not only can PEEP be successful in decreasing the amount of pre-oxygenation time that you have or the requirement that you have. This is that one of those, hey, I can lightly rest an oxygen mask on your face for 5 minutes, or I can put a good seal on and have you breathe as deep as you can 3 times. In the end, we denitrogenate the same. The PEEP can help us either get extra oxygen into the lungs, or when you get those guys that, the CPAPers or the big snores, that extra oxygen can kind of get past that tongue and that tissue blockage and help pre-oxygenate.
So if we can talk about pre-oxygenate for just a minute more, because this one, students, it burns them every time, seeing them here with a student, and I'm not even sure many experienced paramedics understand this, many do. But what exactly is pre-oxygenation? I know, so we follow this National Registry skill sheet and it says to pre-oxygenate the patient, but pre-oxygenation is definitely not hyperventilating the patient. And that's misconstrued a lot with students, EMT students, advanced EMT students. But what do you do for pre-oxygenation? So many times for us, our patients aren't breathing adequately. We're going to be ventilating them. So holding the mask over the face isn't really what we're going to be doing.
So obviously the big thing is that what we're trying to do is get the nitrogen out of the blood. So obviously when we without any sort of oxygen attached to us, we're breathing 21% oxygen. We have a significant nitrogen content in our bloodstream. So in order for, and then obviously when we stop breathing, our reserve is simply how much oxygen do we have circulating? How much oxygen can our tissues pull? Well, the more oxygen we have, the more the time we have. And so the pre-oxygenation is we want to replace and change, get rid of all of that nitrogen that's floating around. So we aren't actually adding oxygen. All we're doing is removing nitrogen. And that's why I keep using the term, you know, denitrogenization. And it's because we want as high content of oxygen in the blood as possible so that that tissue has, you know, if that airway goes poorly, it has the most amount of reserve that it can draw from before we start having any sort of complications.
So how do we achieve that? So, you know, high flow O2, we're going to be ventilating with a bag valve mask at 15 liters.
So if that doesn't work, then obviously one of those is if we do 15 liters on a mask that's not working. Another thing we can do is get a nasal cannula in there, a non-rebreather mask at 15. We can put 15 a peep on. You've mentioned that 15, 15, 15. I think it's easy to remember and it's
yeah. So 15 liters nasal cannula, 15 liters via bag valve mask of oxygen, and then cranking that peep to 15. And once you hit that, you know, whatever your sats are, and what do you go by pre-oxygen? What would we consider pre-oxygenate? So sats of 100. What if sats don't
go up
to 100?
Some people are never going to get to 100. You know, and so the thing though is that it's more of a, how efficiently have you been able to be moving it? If your bag masking is good and this, and the best sat you're getting is 88, that may be what you have to deal with. Now, what you do have to realize is maybe you get that supraglottic out really fast because he doesn't have a lot of reserve. And after that first intubation technique failure, if it happens, now you're at 40% or 62%. Get that super in and start to bag them back up.
So with that in the failed airway, what is an idea? I've seen this in the field. I've seen it with students on mannequins. So they fail an intubation attempt. What is going to guarantee your success the second go? Like, do you just say, hey, I didn't see what I wanted, so I'm just going to try it again? Do you change it up? Do you do something different?
So in our setting, let's say I try with, let's say I start with my classic MAC-3. I get in there and I don't have a good view. As anesthesia, once we've failed, we have to change something. Something isn't working. We don't go at the same thing again, unless we can recognize what the problem is. But as a paramedic, that likely won't occur because you just don't have enough experience with that. So you need to change something. The first thing I would change is position.
Okay.
Change the position, whether it's your height, the patient height, sit them up a little bit more. That would be the first thing I change. And then we at work, we change what blade we're using.
Okay.
So we would take that Mac off. We then would grab a Miller blade and we'd go in with that Miller blade. And if, let's say that Miller blade fails, from there, we're going to put a supraglottic in. We're going to then have whoever step outside, grab one of our videos, and we'd bring that in. So now we'd change it again. And that's where, once we've failed, we have to start coming up with something different. And this is why, this is one of the big things of the supraglottic. It buys you time.
I like it. Yeah, I feel
even if it's
some
just
don't this, change. And I think you're an idiot not to do something different. Like whatever right. You did first go didn't work. You better do something different. Hopefully you can recognize what's wrong. But if anything, change something up.
So the other thing too is that I think one of the things that people, especially new people to intubating, they feel very uncomfortable having that blade in the person's mouth. It's okay if you get it in there and you don't have a good view, that as long as you are not breaking that wrist and getting back on the teeth, it's okay if maybe I need to put a little bit more forward pressure on my blade. Maybe I need to try and lift up a little bit higher and away from me a little bit better. Maybe I need to take that right hand, come across to the front of their throat and start to move that trachea around a little bit, see if I can't displace some of the tissue. All of this, often we see students where I don't see anything. Okay, well, take an extra 10, 15 seconds. We know it feels like an eternity, but the truth is it's not. You'll see sometimes that on these difficult airways, we get in there and it takes us 30, 45, 50 seconds of us manipulating things around before we say, pass me the bougie.
Yeah. Now, with that, and you mentioned leaving the blade in the mouth and us uncomfortable with it, with the gum bougie, once you have it in, before you slide the tube in, do you leave your blade in or you take it out or what do you do? I've heard kind of both, but I've seen a number of people, they just say, let's leave the the Mac 3 or whatever in place, and the Velocular, just kind of let it sit there, and you'll have a better angle to pass your tube over your gumbo shoes. Does that matter at all, or is that BS, or is that a thing?
I think it's personal preference. I take my blade out.
Okay.
And it's simply because one of the big things with the Gumbugee is when you advance the tube, often the tube will get stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll feel like, I can't advance it. I know my bougie's in, but my tube is stuck. And what you need to do is take your bougie and spin it. Or not your bougie, sorry. You take your tube in the bougie and you start to spin it. You start to turn circles and then advance it that way. And for me, I move the blade out of the way because sometimes I need two hands. One that's going to hold the bougie so it doesn't come out. And then the other that's now going to start spinning the tube.
I gotcha. So now with spinning the tube, is that something you do at all? So you don't use stylets at all, but I've seen a number of us with EMS. We do the straight to cuff hockey stick style tube and we go to place it, doesn't go in.
Yep.
I've seen some people recommend, and I mean, it works really good on mannequins, so it has to work great, right? But just rotating about 180 degrees down as you're trying to pass.
Absolutely.
So just change the angle.
So the thing is that not everyone's anatomy is a hockey stick shape.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's simply that you're hitting the top edge of the cords with that hockey stick. So if I turn if I take my tube with the hockey stick and go 90 degrees, I now, instead of having a 45 degree angle up, I now have an angle going to one of the sides and I'm in the middle.
We'll pass.
You know, this is another one of those that manipulating your tube, everybody, they don't think about it until you've done a bunch of them of the vocal cords aren't going to move. I can't really manipulate them in any extravagant manner, but I can move that tube around in all kinds of ways. So let's move the tube.
Perfect. So what else do you have for you? Any other tips and tricks for us?
So I think
for intubators, don't do it very often.
For occasional intubators, here'd be my big tips and tricks. One is learn the proper technique for scissoring open the mouth. Okay. So one of the things, you're going to use your thumb and you're going to use your ring finger. You're going to use your middle finger and not your index finger, but you're going to use your middle finger and your thumb. Your thumb is going to go when you're facing the patient, you're ready to intubate. The thumb is going to go on the bottom molar at the back of the jaw there, that bottom molar. Your middle finger will go on to, I'm trying to think, hold on. This is just weird. It's the bottom. And then your middle finger. So when they're facing you, your thumb is going to go onto the back, as far back as you can get into the molar. Your thumb is going to go onto the bottom. Your middle finger is going to go onto the top. And then you're just going to open your hands. And what you ideally want is that unhinging effect. Okay? Mm-hmm. We've all felt it. We do it when we jaw thrust. We get that little bit of unhinging. But that unhinging, what that's going to do is really open up that mouth. And the reason you want to open up the mouth like that is so that when you get that blade in, it creates a little bit of tension on the tongue so you can get it out of the way easier. The other thing, too, is it gives you the maximum amount of space so that you can displace the tongue and still have a good view. The other thing, so I don't like the term sweeping the tongue. I feel like it gives a kind of the view of a large amount of motion. It's not. You're just moving the tongue out of the way. That's it.
Okay.
So for mine, it's always just enough to move the tongue out of the way to where you can see the epiglottis. And it doesn't matter what blade you're using, that tongue needs to be moved first, then the epiglottis needs to be identified. So when you're getting the habit of tongue, epiglottis, if I'm using a Mac, I then go into the Velocular space. If I'm using a Miller, I then need to get past that epiglottis and move it out of the way as well. And then I think the biggest thing is that I see with paramedic students, the biggest problem that I see is they get into the Velocular space, they lift straight up, and they almost have a view. And in order for them to feel like, I just need that little extra, they rock their wrist. So one of the things that you need to practice is you lift up and away from your body, and that if you need any sort of extra little bit of something, that needs to come from somewhere other than your wrist motion. That when you put that blade in, that wrist, there should be perfect alignment between your forearm and your wrist, and it should be absolutely rigid. There should be no movement at all. And I think that's That's one of the things that by having that rigid forearm and wrist, you'll be able to lift and push out a little bit easier. The epiglottis will lift a little bit more efficiently, and hopefully you've got a better view from there. And then again, use the bougie.
Yeah.
And bougies, you know, if I get a bougie in and it's not going where I need to, pull it out and reshape it a little bit. So.
Cool. All right. Well, Justin, thank you very much. We appreciate all of your advice, all the stuff you talked about. I think we got a lot of really good stuff for both experienced medics, new medics. I mean, even some EMT students that are learning just how to ventilate. Thanks again for for speaking with us on the show. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm glad I was able to come. Thanks for inviting me.
All right. That's the end of part two, the last and final podcast with Justin Bateman over Airway Expertise. We may have him back on in the future, but for now, this one's done. If you have any questions, comments, feel free to email me at Brenton, Brenton, at Medic 101 Podcast. Feel free to check us out on Instagram, Facebook. Please give us a like, follows, especially on iTunes if you would. We appreciate it. If you have any suggestions for podcasts, shoot them my way. We'd be glad to hear them and get some stuff your way. Thanks for listening. Have a good one.